Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley, and our guest today is Judith Valente. Now, Judith has won numerous awards for her work as a former correspondent for PBS, two NPR stations, The Wall Street Journal, and as the author of several spirituality titles. Her most recent books include How to Live, The Art of Pausing, and How to Be. She has published two poetry collections and is a sought-after retreat guide who leads the annual Benedictine Footprints Retreat pilgrimage to lesser-known parts of Italy. She's also president of the International Thomas Merton Society, and the book we're talking about today is The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Judith.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
Now, I know that this is going to be a really popular topic for our listeners because, you know, who doesn't want to savor the full joys of life? And especially in this day and age when there is so many things that can disturb us. And you actually don't shy away from that in the book, do you?
No, absolutely. It's written for people like myself. I always say that I suffer from a dual diagnosis, Monica, overachieverism and workaholism. And I know that there are a lot of people like me out there, but who also want to learn how to live a more reflective, a more contemplative life. And so you can see by relating the titles of my previous books, what has been my obsession, so to speak, in life. You know, the titles are How to Be, How to Live, The Art of Pausing. And The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life, is kind of the next step in that. Because I was able to spend a number of extended stays in Italy over recent years. I mean, extended stays of like 3 months at a time. And I realized that the Italians have the way that they naturally live their lives have a lot of contemplative aspects to it. And so that's what I wanted to write about in the book and how we can incorporate these practices, these ordinary things that Italians do in their daily lives, how we can incorporate them into our lives and live more mindfully and joyfully.
Mm-hmm. What is your connection with Italy?
Well, I have lots of connections with Italy. I'm 100% Italian American. All four of my grandparents came from Italy, and I was very, very close to, particularly my grandfather, my maternal grandfather. He lived upstairs from us part of the year, and he was from Sicily, and he often talked about Italy. And so, you know, it's in my genes, so to speak. And then, as I said, in recent years, I've become more interested in how I could live a more contemplative life in the everyday world, in my professional settings, in my married life. And so I've spent a lot of time in monasteries, and I found out sort of late in life, believe it or not, because I didn't know this grandmother very well. I'm the youngest grandchild, so I didn't know three of my grandparents very well. They either died or were too ill when I was born to get to know them. But one of them lived in Cassino. She's from Cassino, Italy, and Cassino is where Monte Cassino is, and it's the monastery founded by Saint Benedict, the founder of Western monasticism. So my grandmother would have seen this monastery of Saint Benedict, where Saint Benedict lived every day of her life before she emigrated. And I felt like, wow, you know, this has been in my genes the whole time.
And you didn't even know.
I didn't know it until I was an adult and started spending time in Italy and researching my roots.
Wow. Did you still have family members, relatives in Italy?
I have a delightful distant cousin named Mario Valente. We share the same last name. And he's just been a delight to know. He's in the book. And he's in the book in a chapter, or I call the book not chapters, but reflections, in a reflection on the Italian concept of poco ma buono. It's kind of a motto in Italy, little but good. And my cousin sort of taught me about that, because he would go out and buy $5 linguine, for example, $5 pasta, you know, this special kind of pasta to make for his guests. And I would say to him, Mario, you know, you can get linguine for a euro in the supermarket here in Italy. And it's like, no. I'd rather buy less, but it'd be very good, very good for my guests. And I think that's a concept we really don't have in the States, or we really don't follow. You know, we'd rather go to the dollar stores and buy junk and junk food and junk everything else, rather than, you know, spend a little more, buy a little less, but have more quality.
With clothing, that's a good thing too, isn't it? Like, you can have, we have what called fast fashion, which is you go out and buy the latest trend and you wear it one season and then it's gone. And it isn't going to hold up longer than that because it's cheap. It's cheaply made. The fabrics are cheap. It's going to wear out. Or you can buy really, really nice things that you can wear a lifetime.
Yeah. And, you know, people talk about how lovely Italians look, even to go to the grocery store or the department store. And there's a reason for that. I mean, they'll buy less clothing, but more high quality clothing. And they'll dress up the same blouse, for example, or the same suit set with a different scarf or a different purse. And it's part of another Italian concept that I do write about in the book that's fascinated me. Another motto, fare bella figura. Have you heard of that one, Monica, fare bella figura?
Well, not till I read your book.
Not till I read. Okay, good. Okay, I'm glad my book served some purpose then. It's about putting your best impression forward, and that's a very Italian concept. You know, I grew up in a lovely working class neighborhood in New Jersey, and some of the women in our neighborhood would run to the grocery store with pink curlers in their hair and a scarf around their head. You know, that would never do in Italy. And the reason is, it's important to present your best self to the rest of the world. And if I may, I have a little funny story I could tell you about that, Monica. I have a friend who married an Italian, and they were in Italy for a visit. And she was going to run out to the butcher in this, you know, kind of tattered jumpsuit that she probably wore to bed that day. And the husband, the Italian husband, said to her, "You're not going out in that." And she said, "Well, I'm just going to the butcher. Nobody's going to see me." And the husband said, "The butcher will see you." So you see how important it is to present a bella figura.
Oh, yes. So in this book, you say you, rather than chapters, it's organized by reflections. And there's, what, about 20? And yeah, I'm curious about how you chose the topics for this.
Well, it was a lot of just what I observed and what struck me in those, you know, periods of 3 months, 6 weeks, 8 weeks that I would be spending in Italy. So it was all things I observed. You know, I spent most of my career, Monica, as you know, as a journalist, first for print, Wall Street Journal and Washington Post, and then broadcast, PBS and NPR stations. And so, you know, I'm kind of a trained observer as a result of that. And I would, you know, often just sit on my balcony and observe things. Or my husband got bronchitis one time when we were there on an extended stay. And I had to take him to the doctor every day to get a shot, because shots are still common in Italy. Rather than giving somebody antibiotics, they'll give you a shot. And I noticed that the same people were in the doctor's office every day. And eventually, because we had to go there 5 straight days, I realized that these people weren't all there because they were sick. They were there for the conversation. It was, the doctor's office was sort of a place to meet and greet and chat about things. And I began to kind of observe this. And then I noticed how the same people were in the piazza every day. You know, the same groups of men would be gathered under the arches in the piazza every day. Or the same group would be at the same table at the same hour every morning at a particular cafe. And it was because they were talking, and it was a place to congregate and converse. And it made me think about the fact that it's a way of creating a sense of belonging when you have these groups that you meet with every day to have a coffee or to chat with at the doctor's office. It's a way of building community and creating a sense of belonging. And one of the things that, you know, I'm not the first person or a new person to observe this, but the isolationism in our country is rampant. I mean, the Surgeon General has a whole report out about this, about the loneliness that our people feel. And somehow I thought, you know, if people can practice this type of thing, have a group that they meet with every day, even every week, but in person, you know, meet them in person and share with them, this would maybe lessen the loneliness that we feel.
You know, it's interesting because as, you know, as a person of a certain age, I have watched in our country, when I was a kid, there weren't coffee shops, really, not in a lot. I'm sure there were in the big cities, but small towns, you didn't really have the number of coffee shops that we have now. There was a diner, and maybe there were people who went there, but my family certainly never did. And now we have a lot, and I always was sort of envious of what I called the cafe society in Europe, where eating out was so common, and you sat on the sidewalk and you saw people walk by and you engaged with people, and I didn't feel like we had that here. But now, in a lot of places, we do. So why are we more lonely now?
That's a really good observation, Monica, because, you know, I was just at a Starbucks. I don't go to Starbucks all that often, but because it's so expensive, but I love it. I love it. It's a treat. And what do you see when you're in Starbucks? The tables are very close to one another and people are on their phones.
Or computer, their laptops.
Their laptops. Yeah. You know, they're in their own little bubble, their own little cell. That would not happen in Italy. You sit down that close to somebody in Italy, you better be ready to converse. One of the stories I tell in about this is it's very hard to be anonymous in Italy, especially the small Italian towns, which is where I like to stay. And, you know, I'm a Catholic. I go to Mass every day. I love the Catholic Mass. And so I would take the same route every day to Mass in Italy because, you know, there's Masses all day long in Italy. It's a big Catholic country. And, you know, one day these two women just approached me in the street, you know, and said, "Who are you? We see you every day." And it was, you know, it wasn't in the States. It might be startling to have somebody come up like that, you know, out of the blue and say, "Who are you?" But, you know, they were just being friendly. They were like, "We see you every day. You know, we see you every day at the same time. Are you?" They wanted to know, was I there visiting relatives and which, you know, or friends, and who are my friends? Maybe they knew who my friends are. And it's that kind of a society. And I think we don't have as much of that here. It's not that we don't have any of it, but not as much of it.
Well, I got to tell you a funny story. In our in the small town where I live most of the time, which is Fairfield, Iowa, we have some great coffee shops, and one of them is Cafe Paradiso. And my daughter, who had moved, you know, she left to go to college and basically never came back, and that's over 20 years ago. I mean, never came back to live. She's certainly come back to visit, but and her now husband were at the coffee shop, Cafe Paradiso, and they're in line, and this man starts talking to them, and, "Where are you from? Who do you know? Why are you here?" And once he found out that she was my daughter, then it was just like, "Oh, we're best friends," and so forth. And the interesting thing about that is, guess what? He's Italian.
There you go. Yeah, I remember when we lived the first time for 3 months in this one particular neighborhood, and, you know, people who lived in the neighborhood would just stop me on the street and say, "Why don't you know, come to my house for a coffee?" I mean, who would do that in the States? You know, just meet somebody on the street and say, "Come over for a cup of coffee." You know, we're just, it's maybe it's because our society is more violent. Or we're just you know, it might be that way in small towns in America, but a lot of us don't live in small towns. So,
It can be, but not necessarily friendlier in a small town. It just depends. I mean, I've been there for 50 years, so people know me, but you know, it's, I think sometimes when you're new in a small town in America, it can be hard to break in.
To acclimate, to integrate at rather, I think Italy is a we're a kind of an indoor society generally, and I think that goes for small towns too. We're in Italy, it's you know it, there people live in densely populated areas, and they live in apartments largely. If you have a house, it's not going to be a McMansion like. Like some of us are able to have in the US, not me, but some of us. It's an outdoor culture. People have to get out of the house, you know, they have to get out of the house to get air. And so it's a see and be seen culture, which is a difference too. And something I noticed, even in the city of Cassino, I mentioned my grandmother being from Cassino. That even young people are out in the streets a lot. And it's not, they're not congregating at a mall, they're congregating outside. And what are they doing? They're talking. You know, you on a Saturday night, you go past the main piazza in Cassino, and there's all these young people. I'm talking teenagers to maybe late 20s. And they're just outside, they're just talking to each other. I mean, there's this din of multiple conversations rising up in the street.
You know, I used to ride my bike to work past that coffee shop I was talking about in our little town, and there would be a group of people sitting outside, this pretty much the same people every day. Most of them were at least semi-retired, and I used to think, oh, wouldn't it be nice to be able to be part of that like cafe society? And then I thought, yeah, I'd probably be bored in about a week. So how do you adjust from, like you say, being a overachiever, workaholic to just sitting and talking?
That another great question, Monica. You know, I think the environment that you are in then begins to work on you. And for example, I found like I had time enough for everything that I needed to do in Italy, which here I'm always feeling I don't have time enough for anything. I'm always feeling, you know, I wake up with that, what's that thing that I didn't get to do yesterday? You know, I wake up every morning with that thought in my head. And somehow you begin to acclimate to that maybe slower pace of life, slower rhythm of life. And it begins to work on you slowly, like water etching itself into stone. And that's what I've tried to recreate for myself here, and what I hope people who read the book will be able to recreate for themselves.
How do you do that? How do you bring that home with you?
Well, I think a good starting point is to know when to work and when to stop work. I mean, honestly, we really have to put the brakes on when we get off the computer and off of cell phones and off of our email. I mean, I try to put a limit, say 5:30 at night. I try to, or a little bit before 5:30, I try to wrap up because I like to watch the 5:30 news, NBC News. I live in the Midwest, so our news is 5:30. And you know, I try to just shut it down. At that point. And then the rest of the evening is that's my cooking time, my time to talk with my husband, et cetera, time to take a walk, et cetera, et cetera.
Wow. And what are some of the other topics, reflections that you included in the book, and how do they impact your life?
Well, a couple of silly things maybe people will find silly, but I found really helpful to slowing down. And that was most of the houses don't have any dryers, clothes dryers, or None of the apartments are going to have clothes dryers. And that's because, not because they don't have them in Italy or they're too expensive, but electricity is expensive. Mm. And dryers use up a lot of electricity. And so people hang their clothes out to dry. And I found that this became a contemplative practice for me because we had no dryer. We were there in the winter months to boot. And so we had like a sort of a contraption that our landlord gave us to hang clothes. We had a washer, and the washer wrings the clothes out very well, wrings the water out of them very well. So you can hang them, you know, with clothespins on this contraption that he gave us inside the house. But then you learn to check the weather report, you know, every day. Is it going to be over 40 degrees? Well, if it's over 40 degrees, everybody is out hanging their clothing on their balconies. And so you not only get out in the fresh air, but you get out and you see your neighbors. You see your neighbors putting out their laundry. And it becomes kind of for me, it became a contemplative practice. And so when I came home from that first 3 months in Italy, the first thing I did was buy a clothesline.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And I love it. I love it, you know. And the clothespins, even the clothespins were aesthetically pleasing in Italy. I mean, you could buy these multicolored clothespins. You know, here, I always knew clothespins as kind of these wooden things, you know, these monocolored wooden things. But they're all different colors. They come in all different colors. So that was nice. And then I think the sense of what's aesthetically pleasing is very important in Italy. I remember going into a church one time, and a woman that was there at the same time tripped on a step. And I said to the priest, I said, you know, why don't you put like a yellow line there on the step so people won't trip? And he's like, oh, no, that would ruin the whole effect. That would not be aesthetically pleasing. And I always remembered that. And how you'll be walking down, you know, the most ordinary street, and there'll be sort of a painting on the wall. You know, somebody will have painted something on the wall, or they'll have put a statue in an alcove. You know, so there's all these little pieces of beauty that you see as you walk along.
There's art everywhere, isn't
there? Yeah, there's art everywhere, yeah.
And I'm starting to see that more in the U.S. too. You know, I was in Kansas City over the weekend, and there was so much public art, so many sculptures, so many fountains, so many murals that I don't know if they were, you know, I think we're trying to emulate that.
Yes, I agree with you.
More. Yeah,
I think there's a renaissance in public art. I mean, there was for a while, you know, when you had the Works Progress Administration, artists were sent around the country. And now I think we're kind of getting back to it. I don't know where we're going to go with the Trump administration. I'll just leave it there. That's all I'll say about it. But seeing beauty, I think, has an effect on our mood and our soul. And I think it's in no way a waste of money. No way.
You know, one thing that I always, when people talk about like government supporting art as being a waste of taxpayer dollars, my first thought is, what is it that we remember about past eras? We don't remember the political situation. We don't remember how successful they were in business. What lasted? It was the art yes. And the literature and the music. Those are the things that last through the ages. So why do we treat them as if they're less important than business or math or, you know, engineering?
Exactly. This whole thing on math and science. Well, that's, you know, that's great, but we're always going to need to feed the soul as well.
Right. And it's like I said, it has the most lasting impact of anything. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Judith Valente, author of The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. What was it that actually made you want to write this book?
Yes, it really was to speak to people like myself who want to live lives that are a little more reflective and intentional, and to give them some ideas of what they could do. You know, the simple thing, for example, like what I said about the clothesline brings me a great deal of joy. Another thing that brings me a great deal of joy is cooking, and food is enormously important. The dinner table, or the meal table, I should say, is really sacrosanct in Italy. And so I write about in the book about, you know, having reverence for the meal table, that it's not just a place to sit down and shovel food in your mouth. It's a place to really be in communion with other people. And you could relate that to, for example, you know, in a religious context, we have communion when we go to Mass, or when we go, most Christian churches have some form of Eucharist. It's a meal. Mm. And so Italians, being a Catholic country, recognize that a great deal, that the meal table is a place for communion and community. And so that, I mean, returning to that sort of reverence for the meal table, I had a lot of friends my own age, working women, and if they had children, the children were eating at different times because one had soccer practice and one had ballet, or they were eating three different things because one didn't like this and one didn't like that. But maybe we need to just get back to the simple old, everybody sits down at the same time, everybody eats together, everybody chats together, talks about their day. And that's very common still in Italy, you know, that reverence for the meal table. So, you know, that would be something, for example, I think people could do. And the idea of there's a real push in Italy for farm to table, which we are getting more and more here. I mean, you're in Iowa.
Oh, definitely. Yes.
And
yeah.
You understand that probably better even than I do. But the idea of using fresh ingredients, of shopping for the day, you know, I love that. I shopped every day for our main meal, and I loved, you know, just having fresh ingredients every day. Here I slack off a little bit on that because, you know, things stay fresh, you know, a while here, and I'm busier, so I want to cook for more than one day. But
yeah,
I love that idea of, you know, of having a meal every day, of preparing a meal every day, and preparing it with fresh ingredients if possible.
Mm. Judith, why don't you read a little bit from The Italian Soul for us?
I'd be happy to. Thank you. I thought I'd read from the beginning of the book, and it has a little anecdote in here, which I think will be enjoyable, hopefully, for your listeners, about a little lesson that this workaholic had to learn early on. So it comes a little bit at the end of this passage. So this is from the prologue to the book called Pursuing the Sweet Life. This is a book about love. My love as an Italian American for the home of my ancestors, a land that Dante called Il Bel Paese, dove il sì suona, the beautiful country where the yes resounds. It represents the culmination of a quest to nurture in myself that same propensity for living fully that I find in my Italian friends, an attitude that looks out at the world with a sense of openness, attention, and wonder. Whenever I am in Italy, my experience is seen more immediate and intense. I am by nature a hard-charging American, often afflicted with a dual diagnosis of workaholism and overachieverism, always trying to fit more into my days and seemingly never having enough time. In Italy, I somehow have time enough for everything: work, play, family, friends, cooking, cleaning, walking, exercising, and yes, simply doing nothing. Whenever I leave, it is with the haunting intimation that I can indeed reinvent my life in the States to be just as balanced and enchanting. I depart Italy always with the same feeling. I found what I was looking for. I have experienced that feeling only in one other context, on visits to monastic communities. Because I write books that aim to help busy people like myself slow down and live more reflective lives, I've spent considerable time in monasteries, studying, praying, and seeking to learn from men and women who want to rise above the superficialities of daily life, who yearn to see what St. Bernard of Clairvaux called the real behind the real. In short, who seek to live a more contemplative life. What I appreciate most in Italy is its gentler, more balanced way of life. What might be described as a kind of shorthand as la dolce vita, the sweet life. My Italian friends taught me to value the sanctity of the dinner table. I learned from them to prize quality over quantity, to recognize when enough is enough. They introduced me to the simple practice of building community through chiacchiera, the tradition of ad hoc chit-chat that goes on daily in cafes, grocery shops, street corners, park benches, and even doctor's offices, a favored meeting place for sharing news and opinions. They taught me to pride myself on relationships as much as professional achievements. I learned an important lesson about balancing priorities when a friend who lives in the town of San Vito on the Adriatic coast asked me to lunch one Sunday at her home. She invited her parents as well. I usually publish a column on Sundays on medium.com and hadn't finished writing it yet. I brought my laptop computer to the lunch, figuring I could finish my writing before the meal began. When I started typing at the coffee table, my friend's mother looked at me quizzically. I explained to her that I was trying to complete some work. "It's Sunday," she exclaimed. I shut down the computer and kept it out of view for the rest of the afternoon. One more paragraph. The heart of the lesson came later that day. When lunch was over, we all went for a long, leisurely walk along the Adriatic seashore. I remember the walk vividly because I was so touched by how my 36-year-old friend still strolled arm in arm with her parents, and how the sea air refreshed all of us after our delightful, long meal. I finished writing my column later in the day in plenty of time to publish it. I didn't have to sacrifice time in the company of friends. I can enjoy a delicious meal, relax, take a stroll, and still get my work done. For all that, I have my friend's wise Italian mother to thank.
And that's Judith Valente reading from The Italian Soul, How to Savor the Full Joys of Life. Now, one thing that I wanted to ask you about in your bio that you are, the president of the International Thomas Merton Society. Now, right. I think many of us have heard of Thomas Merton, but a lot of us may not know much about him. Tell me a little bit about him and why you are so devoted to his teachings.
Surely, yeah. Thomas Merton was a Trappist monk, which is a kind of a Benedictine monk, but a more rigorous version of Benedictine monasticism. He lived in the 20th century, died in 1968. And he was one of the foremost thinkers on how to live a contemplative life outside of the monastery. I mean, he chose to live in a monastery, but he wrote about how you can basically be a monk in the world. And in fact, his writings, he wrote a best-selling autobiography called The Seven-Story Mountain, which many of us have read and came across in college and became hooked on the other writings of Thomas Merton. But, you know, books like Contemplation in a World of Action, for example, Thoughts in Solitude. These are some of his seeds of contemplation. These are some of the titles of his books. And he talks about what it means to be contemplative in the world, even though he lives in a monastery, because he didn't join the monastery till he was in his late 20s. And so he had this whole other life. And he was a beautiful writer. As I said, his autobiography became a bestseller. He was a poet. His collected poems fill 500 pages. And so he's a beautiful writer. And when Pope Francis came to the United States and spoke to Congress in 2015, he recognized four Americans as being, you know, exemplary models. And one was Abraham Lincoln. The other was Martin Luther King. The other was Dorothy Day, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. And the fourth was Thomas Merton.
Wow.
So, you know, of all the Americans, he included Thomas Merton in that small group of four that he considered models of good living, you know, really compassionate living. And so the Merton Society, we try to promote the legacy of Thomas Merton, encourage people to read his books. We have a conference every 2 years. One is coming up in Denver at Regis University this June. Still not too late to sign up at merton.org. It's just a great group of people like myself who want to live a more thoughtful life, you know, but live very much in the secular world, you know, very much entrenched in the, you know, not in an ashram, not in a monastery, but in the crucible of the real world.
It must be challenging right now to see our nation and some parts of the American Catholic Church going in the opposite direction.
Yes. I don't know when this broadcast will be, but we'll probably have a new pope by the time it airs. And we're hoping for a pope in the model of St. Francis. I mean, I'm already calling him St. Francis because I think he should be a saint. Pope Francis. And I hope we have another pope in that vein of Francis, whom, you know, everyone, Catholic, non-Catholic, religious, non-religious, everybody could see the genuineness and compassion of that man. He wasn't perfect. You know, I wish he said women could be ordained priests or at least deacons. I wish he had done a little bit more about letting lay people have more oversight over church finances. And certainly, you know, he tried to reach out to the survivors of sexual abuse. You know, you can't do enough in that area, in my view. But he did a lot. This Yes. Pope did a lot to restore respect for the Catholic Church after the horrible sex abuse scandal of the early 200s. And so it's heartbreaking to look at what's happening in our country now. We seem to be going backward in so many ways and not forward. And, you know, James Cruz is a poet, a contemporary poet whose work I love, had a poem. He puts a poem every day out on Instagram. And there was one called something about looking for the light. And I might have the title wrong, but you could check James Cruz on Instagram. But it was about we need at this time for our own souls to gravitate toward what gives us light. What gives us sustenance? And, you know, maybe it's cooking, you know, as I said, or maybe it's hanging my clothes on the line or going to daily mass, which to me, I just love the Catholic mass so much. It's my meditation time. So we have to gravitate toward the people also who bring us light.
Mm. Now, did you get opportunities to see Pope Francis when you were in Italy?
I did. I actually met him in person in 2023. And I went with a group of lay associates of Benedictine monasteries, of which I'm one. And we all met him. I thought we were just going to, you know, be able to be in the same room as him, which would have been a delight. But then he beckoned everybody to come forward and shake his hand and have a private moment with him. And of course, as soon as I got there, up to him, I wanted to thank him for everything he was doing for our world and for our church. And I burst into tears.
Oh.
And he was so nice. He just smiled and nodded. He was very nice about it.
Oh, my nephew, John Lemansky, is a priest and studied in Rome for many years and had the opportunity after he was ordained as a deacon to serve with Pope Francis at the New Year's Day Mass, and I think it was 2018. And so I got to go. I took my sister, his mom, and we went.
How
and
wonderful!
To see that, isn't? Yeah, it really was a highlight. Yeah.
I think both of us will be saying one day we saw a living saint, really.
Yeah. So when you write a book like this, is it like, what's your writing process like? Do you outline what you're going to do, or, you know, how do you decide? You sit down each day and just what comes to you that day?
No, absolutely. I have an outline, and, you know, it comes from years of being a journalist, especially when I worked for the Wall Street Journal. You know, those articles that appear on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, which is what I used to write for. They're very lengthy and very, you know, very detailed. And so I have themes. For example, I start with themes that I want to touch on in a book. So writing a book is like, well, writing an article for a newspaper is like running a short, when it's a short race, a sprint, I guess. And writing a book is like running a marathon. That's how I look at it. And so, for example, I mentioned about, I saw all this talking that goes on in Italy. I mean, people are always talking to each other. And so that gave me the theme, the art of conversation. I knew that was going to be one of the themes in the book. And then fare bella figura, you know, I wanted to figure out why are Italians dressed up just to go to the grocery store or the butcher? And so fare bella figura became another theme. And then I became fascinated. You know, I love visiting churches. You know, any city that I go into, I always gravitate. If there's a church, I always try to go in and visit it, see what it looks like because of the beauty, you know, the art that are in these Catholic churches. And also for a moment of meditation and prayer. But I began to see that these statues in Italy were so lifelike. Like, you know, Jesus is really in agony when you see him on the cross. And, you know, and when he's in his tomb, there'll be like red paint depicting blood coming out of his side. I mean, it's very
graphic.
Very graphic, exactly. That's the exact word for it. And so I decided a theme. One of the themes in the book is a bloody Jesus, a Madonna with real hair. And why this is important to Italians to have this, you know, these lifelike statues and, you know, just what makes walking into an Italian church kind of such an experience. And then, you know, the importance of bread to the Italian table. A friend of mine, I remember one time she was chatting with me and then she popped up and said, oh, I've got to go. I've got to buy bread before the store runs out because my father won't sit down to eat unless there's bread on the table. And so I have a theme, you know, another theme in the book, another reflection is called the bread of life and talking about that bread and how the genius of Jesus in deciding that he wanted to be remembered through bread, through ordinary bread and ordinary wine, which are the staples of the dinner table in many cultures. And so, you know, that's how I did it. And, you know, I didn't shy away from some negative aspects of life in Italy either. You know, I felt like I couldn't write a book that didn't talk about the mafia.
Right.
And didn't talk about the fascist era.
Yeah.
Because it remains a mystery to me. I mean, Italians are among the most hospitable people you will meet. I mean, everybody who goes to Italy will say how friendly the people are and how they endured 20 years of fascism is beyond me. I mean, I think it's because they endured it. I think they supported it in the beginning because they thought it was something other than it was going to turn out to be. Similar to what you're seeing now, people who voted for Donald Trump thought they were voting for something other than they're getting right now. But unfortunately, Italians had to live with it for 20 years. They couldn't get rid of Mussolini. And so I write about, well, what might have transpired in the Italian character at that time that fascism would be such a departure from their innate character.
Yeah, and there's still a pretty strong far-right movement in Italy.
There is, sadly, as in most of the European countries. It's, you know, yeah. You look at France and you look at Belgium and Hungary, in our country, you know, sadly,
yeah, absolutely.
Sadly there is. And hopefully this is going to be a passing phase. But one thing, I was very upset when Giorgia Meloni won the premiership a few years ago, because she belonged to a more right-wing political party. And yet she has governed more in the middle than I thought she was. She hasn't cracked down on immigrants. I mean, look, God, compared to what's happening in our country now, I mean, it's absolutely benign how Italy is treating its immigrants. And they really are having an influx of people. An influx of people that's very difficult too, because, you know, Italy is a place where you have basically one culture, one religion, one ethnic group, and people are coming from all over. They're of different races, they're of different cultures, they're of different religions, and it's hard, you know, it's harder to absorb and to integrate in that sense. So I admire the Italians who are trying to help, you know, to help and help people integrate who are coming from cultures that are very different from theirs. I mean, people coming from Latin America they're Americans.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We're North Americans, they're South Americans or Latin Americans. And we're acting like they're so alien to us, which, you know, I don't really understand as the granddaughter of immigrants. So
what I don't understand is how many people who families recently immigrated are so anti-immigrant.
Yeah, and you see this even people who, for example, emigrated from Cuba or Puerto yeah. Rico and became American citizens, sometimes being against people or coming here saying, well, why we came legally, why can't they come legally? Well, they might if the system worked.
Yeah.
You know, if they didn't have to wait 10 years to be able to come, if we had some sort of viable system. And, you know, I think that we have to sort of get off of who we want to keep out and say, okay, how can we help the people who are actually contributing to our society, who are here now, who have been paying taxes, who are working, how can we help them become citizens and remain contributors to our society?
Yeah, the whole thing is a mystery to me. It's like people think, oh, if you're born here, you deserve all this, and if you're born somewhere else, you deserve to die, basically, or to have nothing, to starve, to have your children starve. And a lot of what I get kind of upset about this, because a lot of the people who are fleeing their countries are fleeing situations that our actions help to cause, that United States actions help to cause, or in other cases, you know, in the Middle East or something, that European and American actions help to cause some of the strife that and the really horrible situations that these people are fleeing, and yet we take no responsibility for that.
Yeah. Well, it's the sad story of global politics, really. And, you know, yesterday, well, I don't know when this will air, but yesterday was the anniversary of the fall of Saigon. And what a sad story that was, you know, what a sad, shameful aspect of our history that was.
Now, Judith, when you wrote, like, for the Wall Street Journal, what were you writing about? I'm guessing it wasn't the same things you're writing about now.
Well, I used to try to sneak in stories about faith and values as much as I could. But I originally was hired to cover the airline industry, which was having some difficulties at that time. It was like it is now. It was under a microscope at that time, the airline industry. And then I was asked to simply write for the front page of the Wall Street Journal. And most of that work was human interest articles. So, for example, to its credit, the journal allowed me to write a story, and I mean, it was a long story too, ran on the front page about a religiously conservative business executive caring for his son dying of AIDS at a time when there were still, you know, lots and lots of men, young men dying of AIDS. And it was the story about how this, you know, religiously conservative father in the business world came to this reconciliation, this rapprochement with his son, who was gay. And the son was a tremendous person. He was a well-respected social worker in Chicago, just a wonderful human being. And it was the story of the coming together of the father and the son through the disease, because of the disease.
Wow. So, yeah. So how did you get started as a journalist?
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because my first love was always poetry. And
as different as possible.
Not too much money in that. I have a new collection of poems also coming out called How to Be a Contemplative. That's the title poem. All in the same vein, coming out in May or June, it'll be out. But I loved poetry and I wanted to write. You know, I knew from a very early age, maybe the age of 4, that I wanted to be a writer, believe it or not. It was something so innate in me and God-given. And then I saw journalism as a way to earn a living. And actually, reading a lot of poetry, writing poetry, I think made me a better journalist. It made me a much better writer than I might have been. So each informs the other.
What are some ways that you think poetry made you a better writer?
Just to talk about craft a minute, technically, for example, in poetry, the choice of a word is very important. You want to choose a word that might be surprising, a verb that might be surprising and not so trite. And so in my journalism, I had a practice of underlining all my verbs to see, you know, was there one that would be more exciting, more descriptive, more unexpected that I could use? Same thing with nouns. You know, I would look at nouns and see, you know, am I just using the easy noun, or is there a better, more descriptive, more concrete noun that I could use? And then, you know, poets are also observers. You know, I always say that, you know, doctors, ministers, clergy, and reporters are we're all trained observers. And so, you know, poets are always looking around. What's really happening? What's the story behind the story? And I think that's what I used to look for when I was a journalist. Like, I could have written a story about any father taking care of his son dying of AIDS. But what was unique about that story was that this was a religiously conservative father, business executive, you know, who basically wanted to disown his son at one point. And so, you know, you look for the untold story, I guess, as a poet. And as a journalist, I did the same thing.
I really like your thought about, you know, looking at every single verb.
Yeah.
Now, do you do that in these books too, or, you know?
Definitely. When I write a book, yeah, it's the same process, right? And you know, a lot of rewrite. Somebody said, I think it was E.B. White, that writing worth reading is rewriting. So that's where, you know, often the real work is done, is in the rewriting. People often want to know, well, how do I get started? I have a book I want to write. How do I get started? I say, well, apply the seat of the pants to the seat of the chair and start writing. You know, just start writing without editing yourself, without self-critiquing. And then you go back and do all the hard work.
So you write first draft straight through?
Usually I'll try to write something straight through and then go over it very carefully. Not once, not twice, but several times.
Wow. How do you know when you're done?
I guess you're done when the deadline is. When you've hit your deadline.
So tell me about your publisher.
I absolutely love my publisher, Hampton Roads, which is it's the spirituality. See, my book is like a bridge between travel and spirituality. And Hampton Roads does a lot of spiritual books. And so it was interested in trying to bridge the two markets, travel and spirituality. So, you know, a person who's not very spiritual could read my book and love it because it's about Italy and gives you a lot of insights about Italy. But a person who's spiritual would enjoy my book as well. And Hampton Roads is a part of a bigger company called Red Wheel Wiser, which is based in Boston. And I love working with them. When you work with a smaller publisher, you get a lot of individual attention. And they were lovely. You know, they let me use pictures in the book. They came up with a beautiful cover for the book, which will entice anybody to want to go to Italy. And I mean, it's a nice little book that you could put in your backpack or your purse. It might fit into if you have a nice sized purse and your briefcase. So I really enjoy them very much.
And have you been publishing with them all along?
I've had a few publishers that I've enjoyed all of them. My last three, this is my third book with Hampton Roads. I did How to Live First, which is a book on how we could use the Guide for Monastic Living, the classic guide for monastic living, which is called The Rule of Saint Benedict, how we could apply that to our modern everyday lives. So it's called How to Live, What the Rule of Saint Benedict Teaches Us About Happiness, Meaning, and Community. And then they published a collection of my letters back and forth with a Trappist monk in Thomas Merton's Abbey. This was a monk who had studied under Thomas Merton, had been a novice under Thomas Merton. And that book became How to Be, A Monk and a Journalist Reflect on Living and Dying, Purpose and Prayer, Forgiveness and Friendship. And so it's our letters back and forth on a lot of issues that are both practical and spiritual, like issues like how do you know when to leave a job, for example. I mean, I was struggling in some of the letters about whether I should leave journalism, full-time journalism, and just write books. And so this monk, you know, was very helpful to me and talked about how he had to decide about when it was time to leave his job in the kitchen as the cook for the monastery. It's the same thing. They go through the same thing. And then COVID occurred while we were exchanging these letters. And so there were a lot of letters about, you know, facing death, seeing death, seeing so much death, and how is that viewed by people in monastic life? So that was the book, How to Live, that I did with Hampton Roads. And I have a book called The Art of Pausing that I did with St. Mary's Press, and a book called 20 Poems to Nourish Your Soul, which are poems by well-known poets, but I wrote reflections to go with the poems. And that was done by Loyola Press. Wow. And I have nothing but good things to say about all of those publishers.
You're very fortunate to have found such wonderful publishers, I think. And we were very fortunate to have you as our guest today, but we are out of time now. And we always close with a quote. So I was searching for a Thomas Merton quote that would work here, and I think this one does. Let us come alive to the splendor that is all around us and see the beauty in ordinary things.
Beautiful. Perfect. Well, this has been a joy talking about savoring the full joys of life. This has been a joy, Monica.
For me too. Thank you so much, and see you all next week on Writers' Voices.